I've been looking forward to this week for a while now. I think the last couple weeks have been pretty heavy, but maybe in a good way. This week we're talking about something that I think in a lot of ways is a lot lighter, but not less important, and it's just the idea of friendship. Of course, when we go to 1 Samuel, we read about what is probably the most iconic friendship in all of the Bible. To catch you up, if you haven't been following along with us so far, David has received this incredible anointing on his life to be king, but he doesn't know that yet. And he has fought and just defeated Goliath in this huge military battle. And so it seems like David, at this point in time, he's at the top of the world, right? Everything is going great for David. But what we will see in the life of David is David never stays on the top for long. It seems like his life in a lot of ways is kind of like this roller coaster of ups and downs and, you know, like bumper cars, all these different things that are just coming at him. If it's lions or it's bears or it's giants or it's homicidal kings, there's always something around the corner for David. And what's amazing is here in a little bit, we see that Saul, the king, is about to turn into a murderously jealous psychopath in a way, trying to kill David. In fact, he tries to kill David 6 times in just 3 short chapters, essentially. But what's amazing is that all in the midst of this turmoil for David, you can see that like right in the middle, there's this friendship that the Bible talks about with David that in a very literal sense is a saving grace for him. And so I want to talk about friendship. And before we go to the text, I want to maybe challenge how we define friendship, because I think friendship is something that for a lot of us is defined kind of poorly, right? I think a classic example of this for me personally is Facebook. You all know that I hate Facebook with the wrath of 1,000 suns. I've talked about that. I think it's like, why someone would choose to have like 1,000 fake friends instead of 5 real ones is beyond me. I'm on Facebook in that I have an account, but I'm not on Facebook the way that a lot of people are on Facebook. I go and I just post every once in a while something about the church, but like to just log on to Facebook and scroll through my feed, I never do that. I don't think I've checked my feed in 2019 so far. In fact, the little world icon, it just stays all the time at 99. And if for some reason that ever messes up, I really don't like it. It bums me out. So I don't check it. And it gets really awkward for me in a lot of ways, because while I am probably in the most literal sense a casual Facebook user, other people are more hardcore users, right? I'm more like amateur and they're professional. And so it's weird when I'll get a message, you know, that's something like, "Pastor David, my best friend killed themselves and now I want to kill myself too." And I'm like, and I don't check it for like 3 months. And so I'm just thinking, so I write back, "Hey, hope everything's all right." It's funny, my wife and I, we've actually had this happen to us before where people will write something on Facebook just on their wall and they would expect me and Jordan to know about these big events in their life. You know, they'll come and I'll say, "Hey, where you been?" And they'll say, "Mission trip." And they would want us to know because it's on Facebook. And that's not really the way that I use Facebook. I think people are thinking, you know, because I'm a pastor. So I think people are thinking that what I do is I just preach on Sunday and then walk around the mall the rest of the week. Just aimlessly. Just walk around and check Facebook. Facebook is about to get really extra exciting here pretty soon as we enter into the political season. So all of you who are on Facebook and use Facebook, have fun, everybody. Just cut each other, stab each other, wound each other, bleed everywhere. I'm just glad I don't have to see any of it. But I think Facebook here, the real problem is this for me. I think that Facebook and maybe social media as a whole has begun in a very real way to redefine what it means to be a friend, right? Like, how many friends do you have? Well, you can just go on Facebook, right? And there's like just a number right there. It shows you, I have 3,700 friends. Like, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but you guys know that those people aren't all your friends, right? Like, all those people do not care about you. And you know what? You don't care about all those people, right? You can't. Those are people that you are trying to impress. and trying to impress you, right? And I think it's turned this, the word friend into just kind of this big general thing that has mostly to do with just, these are people that I know somewhere in my life, but it's not a friend, right? The people you're trying to impress. I have never in my life bought a new car, right? I've always had older cars, never really cared for a new car. Until last year, my wife drove, when we got Grace, right, our baby girl, and my wife was driving a 17-year-old Civic with bald tires, and so we knew we cannot put the baby in that car, right? And so we went to the dealership and got ourselves a brand new Honda. And you should have seen it when it first came off the lot. It was immaculate, right? The paint, it was sleek. It was sexy. It was clean. And so it was like, I've never had a flawless car before. And then we went to Walmart one day. Oh, y'all have been. Yeah. So we went to Walmart one day and we go grocery shopping and we come out and we see on the side of our car, we see a ding and a scratch. And so I look at it and you know what? I see it and I just think this. Oh, thank God. I was just like, I'm so glad it finally happened because it was so stressful for me. It was stressful for me to have like a brand new immaculate car. I found it to be a terrible experience. Like I much prefer to have a ding in our car. It's great for me. I feel like having a perfect car is almost like having a perfect body. Like what a nightmare. It's like three Cheetos and this all goes away. Awful. But so I prefer my car with dings. And I think in a very real way, you might think about it like this. Friendship is where it's okay for you to have dings. That's my point, right? Then that's the opposite of Facebook. Facebook is where you're trying to act shinier than you really are. Friendship is where it's okay for you to not be perfect, right? To have scratches, to have dings, that friends have access to parts of you that other people don't. Henry Nouwen, I've talked about Henry Nouwen before, but he's an author that to me, I think he can kind of reach into my heart and give words to things that I feel in a way that no other author can. That's me personally. When I read Henry Nouwen, oftentimes I will actually be reading it and I'll cry. And I never read when never cry when I read. Never. But Henry Nouwen, he just has a way with words. He wrote this book called The Life of the Beloved. And in it, talking about friendship, he says this: "The greatest gift my friendship can give you is the gift of your belovedness. I can give that gift only insofar as I have claimed it for myself." Isn't that what friendship is all about? Giving each other the gift of our belovedness. And he goes on to say this: "Deep friendship is the calling forth of each other's chosenness and a mutual affirmation of being precious in God's eyes." I love that definition, that what a friend is supposed to do is to give you the gift of your belovedness. Beautiful. Okay, 1 Samuel chapter 17. David has just killed Goliath, right? Last week we ended on verse 54. We're starting at verse 55 today. So he's just killed Goliath. As Saul, he's the king, watched David going out to meet the Philistine, he said to Abner, commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is that young man?" Abner replied, "As surely as you live, your majesty." I don't know. I find this funny. It's like, "As surely as you live." I'm not sure. This is like, I think people, you don't have to like back up with your life that you don't know. When you don't know, people believe you, right? "As surely as I live," I'm not sure. The king said, "Find out whose son this young man is." As soon as David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul, with David still holding the Philistine's head. This is a lovely picture. So he goes to the king and he's still holding Goliath's head. "Whose son are you, young man?" Saul asked him. David said, "I am the son of your servant Jesse of Bethlehem." After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. It's a beautiful picture of friendship. verse 2 in chapter 18. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. So here you see that David has a big life change, that at this point he's not able to return home, but he instead stays with the king. Verse 3. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. There it is again. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. So here you can see Jonathan is literally giving David the clothes off his back. But more is happening there in actually what's happening when he's giving him his tunic and his armor. He's essentially giving him the throne. He's saying that you should be the coming king, that he says, I want you to be the next king. Verse 5, whatever mission Saul sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. I find it beautiful that for David, that's in the midst of all of this trial and tribulation that David is going through, that there's this safe space that is in his relationship with Jonathan. In fact, I personally believe that his relationship with Jonathan is one of the things that enables David to be as successful as he really was. And I think it's a really, in a lot of ways, kind of an unlikely friendship, right? Jonathan, of course, is King Saul's son, so he is the heir apparent. So he is the one who is next in line for the throne. So you would think that he would have more reason than anybody else to actually be jealous of Saul or David, suspicious of David, right? Because he's thinking like, who does this young punk think he, like, I am the next king, and here my dad is giving all this attention to this young little dude. But Jonathan was not suspicious of David. Right? He wasn't threatened by David. I could say a lot about how important it is to be in friendships where you're not threatened by each other, but he's not threatened by him, right? In fact, he becomes David's biggest advocate. In fact, in 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, at the very beginning, to jump forward in the story a little bit, David he's lamenting the death of his great friend Jonathan. Sorry for the spoiler. Jonathan dies, and there in 2 Samuel recorded is what's known as a dirge. It's like a funeral song that David writes for his beloved friend Jonathan. Look at what he says. He says, I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. No, I do not believe the text indicates that there was any sort of erotic relationship happening, but I think it's an amazing statement here. Is what he's saying is this, that, you know, I've had wives, but your friendship actually meant more to me than any wife. And that's an amazing thing. It's almost a bizarre thing to say in our modern culture, right? Because I think friendship is absolutely undervalued. I actually think that. And you see, C.S. Lewis, he wrote a book called The Four Loves. If anyone ever read The Four Loves, pick it up. He talks about friendship, and one thing that he says is this, that all the relationships that somebody has, friendship is the only one that's not required for your survival, right? So he says, think about sexual love, right? You need it if you're going to propagate the species. Of course, you need family love if you're going to pass down your DNA to the next generation. And even to a certain extent, you need business associates, right? People, if you're going to accomplish anything bigger than yourself, like building a pyramid or something. But friendship, you just like, you kind of don't need it. It might be nice to have, but you don't need it. And I think that's a tremendous understatement and misunderstanding of what the purpose of friendship is. I think that you were designed, even if you don't think you are, you were absolutely designed for relationship, for connection. Right, there's a lot of stuff we could say about the Genesis creation narrative, but just one. Let me say this: when it comes to the story of Adam and Eve, is Adam was living in absolute perfection, and he was lonely. Think about that. He was living in perfection, and he was lonely. So to be lonely is not to be sinful, right? To be lonely is to be human. made in the image of God, right? Who has within himself relationality. I think it's really funny when you think about, I love this story, is Stanley Hauerwas. Does anybody know Stanley Hauerwas? He's a cool theologian, kind of famous. He's super wacky and he's super brilliant. Time magazine recently called him America's best theologian. And so if you can picture your like crazy uncle, but then picture him as a brilliant theologian, and that's kind of like what Stanley Hauerwas is. Well, he tells this story of years ago, he was leading a class. He was doing a class at a university on friendship, biblical friendship, and he was asked to go and watch the show Friends. And so it's just personally for me, it's like my happy place to think of Stanley Hauerwas on a Thursday night, like going through the back catalog of Friends. I just love that. But predictably, he hated it, right? And he came back and he cursed about it and curses about a lot of things. But he told his class, he says this, he says, "I cannot believe that anyone would want to be friends with any of these people." He says, "These are some of the most despicable, selfish, self-centered people I have ever seen in my entire life. I can't believe anyone would want to be friends with them." That was his response. I just thought that was cool. But he goes on to say that the very fact that that show and shows like that are as popular as they are proves to me that people are in desperate need of real, authentic, meaningful, vulnerable friendship. Right. In fact, and he would go on to say this. I thought this was so great. Stanley Hauerwas, he defines this like this: friends are the people who make you feel more at ease with yourself. I love that. They're people that make you feel more at ease with yourself. And you know, for me personally, I feel like I've always been pretty good. My parents might tell you otherwise, but I've always been pretty good at making friends. Like I think I'm pretty friendly. Like, don't you think? I mean, in all fairness, I'm pretty friendly. But let me tell you what happens when you're in ministry, and this is kind of weird. I didn't see this coming. That for me, when you're in some sort of like public, I don't know, light or something, there ends up being a lot of different people, and so you end up being friends with everybody, and thus nobody in particular. Right, it always seemed so bizarre to me that people said that like being a pastor is actually kind of lonely. That doesn't make any sense. Everyone wants to be around them, but it's incredibly lonely. And the reason is this: is you try to be friends with everybody, right? You try to love everybody, but as a result, you don't get to know anybody in particular particularly well, you know. And for me, I can say this, that I consider myself a pretty truthful person. And not that I don't lie, but that I'm truthful about myself and what I feel. Right? Like I feel like even when I preach, 90% of who I am is just open to everybody. I just get up here and I just bleed all over the place. Right? I just always sharing about myself. I think 90% of who I am is for anyone who has the internet, it's just public knowledge, right? It's like part of the public record. You can know 90% of who I am. In fact, it's funny that people will say, you know, like, "Oh, David, I wish I could get to know you or know how you really are." Listen, like, this is who I really am. Like, and we could have coffee, but I promise you this: I'm more myself when I'm doing this than I will be when I'm having coffee with you. I can promise. Like, this is honestly as real as I get. 90% of who I am is just open to everybody. But what I noticed was this, is that while I'm really open with the 90%, I can be extremely guarded with the 10% with anybody. And so for me, something that I've learned and God's been working with me is that I feel like in a lot of ways, if I'm not careful, that can make me a really great casual friend and a really crummy deep friend, right? And so, and that's what happens for people in ministry, because, you know, it's like you want to have 500 friends, but they understand that there's this distance So even though they're friends with you, it's not like this deep friendship that I think that we're supposed to, really, really have. And so if you're wondering kind of where I'm at with all of that, I've learned that, I won't sacrifice somebody on the altar of everybody, right? You just can't. And so that's why for me and my wife, like we have probably these 5 or 10, friends in our life that have access to us in ways that nobody else does. And that's not because I don't want to be friends with everybody. It's because not only do I want to have good friends, I also want to be a good friend. So I was trying to think if there was anything I could do that would be at all practical here. And so I have for you 4 things. If you're taking notes, you can write them down if you want. 4 things on how to make and how to keep deep friends. So number 1 is this, utilize the Grover principle. I think that one pretty much speaks for itself. Just kidding. Okay, so you guys remember Grover, Sesame Street? So there's this scene where what he does, he's there with some of his friends, and Grover gets jealous because his friends are getting letters in the mail, and he's not getting any letters in the mail, and he's jealous. He's upset about that. Well, eventually, some of his friends come up to Grover and say, Grover, if you want to receive letters, then you have to send letters. And if you send letters to people, they'll probably write you back. And so Grover sits down with a pad and with a pen, and he writes his first letter, Dear Mom, wish you were here. And he found out that when he writes letters, that people write him back. I realize that that's like a lesson for 5-year-olds. In fact, it feels extra dumb right now. Much dumber than when I was preparing. But I realize that feels dumb. Here's my point. I think that a lot of people stew in their own loneliness all the while expecting other people to like magically know that what they want is friendship. I wish it worked like that. I actually do. I wish that that's how it worked, but it doesn't, right? Like if you want friendship, oftentimes you're the one who has to send the letter before you receive the letter, right? And oftentimes you actually have to go out and be intentional, right? It takes effort to both make friends and it also takes effort to keep friends. You know, and I think as basic as that sounds, gosh, that's basic. But I think that there's a lot of people that don't enjoy deep friendship simply because they're expecting deep friendship to happen automatically, and it doesn't, right? You have to be deliberate about it. Number 2, if you're taking notes, is this. Ask God to help you recognize existing friends, right? Like I think that, and I don't mean just like recognizing like, oh, hey, that's my friend, Steve. But like recognizing friends for who they really, really are. This is what happens with David and Jonathan, right? That Jonathan looks at David and he recognizes something in David that feels at home in him, right? That there's something that he recognizes that there's something happening with their hearts and they're connecting with each other. If you guys know John O'Donohue, he's like an Irish poet. When he wrote this book called Anam Cara, and this phrase Anam Cara in Celtic, it means soul friend. And what he goes on to say is he says that we have these soul friends in our lives, but oftentimes we don't recognize them for what they really are. And that it's not until someone's sick or someone's dying or worse, even dead, that you realize what that person meant to you and who they were in your life, right? But an Anam Cara. So I think the prayer would be like, God, who is it that you have put in my life now that I can really invest in, right? Some people that are maybe praying for new friends, I really think possibly your response might be to nurture the friends that God has already given you more. Martin Buber, he's a Israeli philosopher. Great name, right? Martin Buber. Amazing figure. It's probably Buber, but I don't think it is. He says this, the greatest thing any person can do for another is to confirm the deepest thing in them, in him, in her, to take the time and have the discernment to see what's most deeply there, most fully that person, and then confirm it by recognizing it and encouraging it. I love that. Just that that moment of recognition, right, where you see who that person is and you speak into their belovedness. But ask God to help you recognize existing friends. Number three is this, and I've only got four. I'm going good. Can I be honest? I talked for so long last week. I didn't have a timer. So now they actually have a countdown timer for me this week. So I'm being good. I didn't know what time it was. I preached for almost an hour last week. Sorry. Three, have the courage to share how you feel. Wow, this is so basic. I can't believe how basic this is. But I think you need to understand this, that if you keep your guard up in relationship, it will most certainly block you from being hurt, but it will also block you from having deep and meaningful friendships, right? Without openness, there is no deep connection, right? Like I think about my friend, Trish. I don't know how long I've known Trish, but a while now, but I'll never forget that like early on in our friendship, I would walk up to Trish and I'd say like, oh, hey, how are you doing? And she would say, I'm all right. Kind of had a hard day at work, you know, and my family's going through kind of a hard time right now. I'd be like, oh, wow, we're really talking. You know, I was just thinking you're just like, good, you know. Hey, how you doing? Good. How you doing? Good. Okay. But she just has this like willingness to open up. And so it probably should surprise nobody that within a very short period of time, I was free to open up about myself with Trish. Right? But it took that like openness. So if you're thinking what I want is I want deep friendship, but I still want to keep my guard up and I want to always maintain this appearance of always looking right and strong and perfect, it's not going to happen. Right? Like you have to have the courage to share how you feel. Right? Like this is the pastoral mistake for me. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I'm so used to other people being vulnerable with me. And then 5 years down the road, I find that I have no one to be vulnerable with. I'm not going to let that happen. It's going to be the right people. And I know all the different relationships have the right blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying just blab everything. But having those people where you can really communicate actually how you feel and then have the courage to do it. And just believe this, that your friends can see the best of you and the worst of you. But they love you anyways, and they're constantly reaffirming your belovedness. George Eliot, she's a poet, and she's a she. She says this, this little poem, I thought it was beautiful. Oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh nor measure words, but pouring them all right out just as they are. Chaff and grain together, certain that a faithful hand will take and sift them, keeping what is worth keeping, and with a breath of kindness, blow the rest away. It's beautiful, right? To have people in your life that you can be real with, right? Like what you actually feel, that you're not trying to impress, you're not jealous, but you're just open with each other, and you're confident that each other, that you're good stewards of each other's soul, right? That you're not, that, you know, there's friends, I mean, especially us dudes, like, right, we're joking and we're sarcastic. That's all fine and funny and cool. But at the end of the day, like, if I don't feel like your agenda is to speak into my belovedness, then you are messing up, right? Like, there has to be an overarching piece that you are moving towards affirming people's worth. Right? That like they're friends with you, and because they're friends with you, they feel better about themselves. And maybe they even have the effort to become better. Right? And so speaking, having the courage to be open and being a good steward of each other. Think about 1 Samuel chapter 20. So this is three chapters later. In fact, why don't we say this? This is your homework. Read 1 Samuel chapter 20. It's the coolest story about friendship. There's like all of these, there's an arrow and there's secret messages. It's really, really cool. But essentially what is happening is this, is that Saul's murderous wrath has begun to burn against David. Right. And Jonathan knows this. And Jonathan, essentially, he throws himself in the line of fire, in front of his father's wrath to save his friend David. And so David is in hiding, and, this is them reuniting. 1 Samuel 20 verse 41. After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. They're reuniting. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" Then David left and Jonathan went back to the town. I just think there's something so beautiful about these two rugged warriors just getting together and holding each other and just weeping. You know what I mean? Like, these guys are military, you know, tough guys. Like, even for their day, they were like tough dudes. But to just come together and to be open, right? That, you know, how different is that from modern day friendship, right? How different is that than what we like think we have on Facebook, right? There's, I'm just trying to impress you with like my brilliance and how beautiful I am. Like, real friendship is where you don't have to do all of that stuff and you can be open. And I'm not saying that if you don't cry on each other, that you're not real friends, but I'm saying that there has to be, if you want to have a deep friendship, there has to be some meaningful vulnerability with each other. And sometimes that has to start with you, right? And of course it's risky, right? Of course showing your heart to somebody else is risky. But the truth is this, is that love requires risk. It does. You think about C.S. Lewis, right? He has this quote. I think it's beautiful. It's in this book, A Grief Observed, he's lamenting the death of his wife, right? Who he would come and he would describe as his best friend in life. And look at what C.S. Lewis says in his mourning. "To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it," talking about your heart, "intact, you must not give your heart, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable." And I think, you know, for me, I feel like I'm deeply aware of this because in church, there's just always this influx and outflow of people, right? It's just this revolving door of different people come in and out. And what I think is really funny is that there's people, it seems like the people who are the most gung-ho are the people who are like the quickest to leave. That's just me. You know, some people will come up and be like, "God, David, I love this church. You know, I've been looking for this church my whole life." It's like 3 weeks later, gone. Right? Or like, "David, I never felt like anyone understood me until that sermon, and now I love you more than anyone else in the world." It's like, oh God, you're going to leave, aren't you? But you know, there's just this sense of like they're always being in and out. And so it's really easy for people who spend as much time in the church as I do, and a lot of you do, there's this really easy tendency to kind of become guarded with people, right? As long as you keep them at a certain distance, they can't hurt you, right? But they also can't really love you. And it's hard for you to really love them. Number four is this, and I'm totally done. Number four is this: bless others without reservation. I think so much of relationships today is, you know, my needs, right? And what, you know, you scratch my back and I'll scratch your back. Like, just be done with all of that kind of stuff and just be content to be the person who does the blessing, right? And it's like just this posture of, no matter what, I'm going to bless you, right? Like no matter what, the way that I treat you is not contingent on how you treat me, right? Like, even if you don't love me, I will always love you. And I'm not talking about like some fatal attraction way, like I will always love you and then you cook their pet rabbit. But honestly, like this posture of, just no matter what, right? Like I am here to out bless you, right? Friendship where you're content to be the blessing instead of always evaluating whether or not everything that you do is reciprocated by the other person. To just be done with that. To try to out bless the other person. And I'm not talking about abusive situations, right? I'm not forgiveness. You need to forgive, but forgiveness does not mean staying. Forgiveness does not mean staying silent. Forgiveness does not mean forgetting, right? Get out of there. I'm talking about how to be a good friend, right? And when it comes to friendship, I just love this idea of trying to outbless the other person. This was some advice I got years ago when me and Jordan were just, we were engaged to be married, and we were talking to John Woods. He's like a hero of mine here at the church. And he said, what you need to do is you need to constantly try to outbless your wife. And so then if you're ever feeling like, I feel like I clean up more than she cleans up, then you just think, awesome, I'm doing it. You know, and he says, if you have two people that are trying to outbless the other person, well, you've got probably the best marriage in the world. Right? And I just think that that's true for friendship as well, especially when we're so sensitive about how we're being treated and, you know, this scratch my back, scratch your back thing. But just try to outbless your friend. There's actually a name for people who try to outbless their friends. You ready? Popular. Like, everyone wants to be around people who are just constantly building up other people, right? You think about like Teresa Smith. I know a lot of you guys know Teresa. This amazing, tall, blonde, gorgeous lady. She moved to Phoenix, but she was almost my mentor when it came to preaching in a really real way. But the thing that I'll never forget about her is that when I was with her, I felt better about myself and I tried to become better. Right? Like feeling bad about yourself is not nearly as good of a motivator as you think it is, right? Like when you feel okay about yourself, then oftentimes there's actually space, you know, like this being in a place where you sense God's love and you sense other people's love. That's actually the environment where real change can take place. And I just think it's such an amazing gift. Like, this is a simple sermon, but such an amazing gift to be able to go to somebody else and to speak into their belovedness, right? And so 10 years from now, maybe you move, but that they would think back, right? They would think back about Jessica, or they would think back about Hannah, and they would think like, when I was around Hannah, she made me feel like I was a loved person. Like, what a great picture of that. Jonathan Martin, he used to be a pastor. He's kind of a traveling speaker guy. But he wrote something that I clipped years ago. And I just thought it's so good. And then I'll be done. We'll receive communion right after this. So you guys can go. Oh, they're already ready. Get ready again. All right. Jonathan Martin says this. What about a friend for whom you would take a bullet, not out of some general Christian ethic or some sense of nobility, but because you genuinely cherish their life more than your own? A friend for whom, if they were in an accident, you would run all the red lights until you got to them. It is far easier to insulate myself with many superficial relationships than to embrace the vulnerability required to have that kind of friendship. But in that unselfish love, in that constant affective desire to do good to one another, risk melts away. And in place of all that guardedness and political image management, the only question that remains is, what will do you the most good in this particular moment? For you to be well, for you to be safe from harm as far as I can keep it from you, for you to thrive and be everything you are meant to become, in what way can I support you? In what way can I carry you? It's a love without contingencies, a love without constraints. It's love without a backup plan. Not a crass, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. Not I'll serve your best interests if you serve mine. But I'll do good by you and for you always, whatever that means and whatever that requires. It would seem that to even have one friendship like that would be enough to make a man unspeakably rich. I hope to be a great preacher, a great leader, a great writer, but to be a really good friend, that would really be something. Right? Which of course brings us to Jesus, right? Jesus is amazing in that he is simultaneously the best friend that you could ever have. And he is the perfect example for you in how to be a good friend to other people, right? And so as we receive communion, what I'm wanting you to do, and I won't talk too long, I'm wrapping it up. I want you to think about this, like what an incredible idea it is that the creator of the universe, like for real, the creator of the universe would come and he would call you his friend. And not in some super generic general, we're floating in the sea of God's love somewhere, but like he loves you in particular. And in particular, he calls you his friend. So just meditate on that for one moment. Hold on to the communion elements. And then once you have them, I'll hop back up and we'll receive communion together. Thank you, guys.
And I can't get enough. No, I can't get enough of your amazing love.
Invitation is on the screen. This is the table, not of the church, but of the Lord. It is made ready for those who love him and for those who want to love him more. So come, you who have much faith and you who have little, you who have been here often and you who have not been here long. you who have tried to follow and you who have failed. Come, because it is the Lord who invites you. It is his will that those who want him should meet him here. So come to the table. Allow me to pray for you. Father, today I come and pray for just my friends here in the room, all the different relationships. And I know that there's some people in here that have an unbelievable amount of strength and support in other people in their lives. And there's other people that feel profoundly alone. And they feel like they are here in the world without a helper. And a lot of people in between those too, right? And so my prayer would be that for all of those people, that you would teach us in your gentle and patient way how to be a really good friend. And how to make friends when we need to make friends, and how to care for friends when we need to care for friends. And maybe most of all, just help us to be a good friend to the people that you've given us, Lord. And Jesus, as we come to your table, we're just so amazed by this idea that you would come and you would call us your friend. We remember that nobody here is deserving of what you give us, but we're all just equally invited. And so we say thank you, and we receive your gift. It's not about us doing, it's just about us being your sons and daughters. And so we say thank you, and we receive you, and we commit our lives to you. So Jesus, today we remember your death, we proclaim your resurrection, and we await your return. Let's eat the bread and drink from the cup together.